Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original pieces on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree, it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in Washington, D.C. today at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. Over the past few decades, as China's economy has continued to expand, charitable activity by corporations and foundations has also increased. Philanthropic activity by individuals, too, has grown, as we should hope and expect it to. After all, China now boasts the world's largest number of billionaires, 55, I think it was, in 2017. Once in a while, we read about surges of volunteerism, like after the 2008 Wenchuan earthquake, for instance, or another natural disaster here or there. International media will focus on somebody like Alibaba's Jack Ma for, you know, the large donations to environmental NGOs that he's made. But we'll also read about scandals that have caused many ordinary Chinese to be very skeptical. And we read routinely about the casual brutality, the callousness, the pitifully low levels of trust in Chinese society. Meanwhile, the third sector, voluntary and nonprofit institutions, NGOs, you know, the mainstays of civil society, they're really circumscribed to a great extent in China. The party state regards these things with a certain ambivalence, sending that sector what my guest today has called the dual message of expectations and apprehension. That guest is Scott Kennedy, as well-known in academia as he is in think tank land. Scott is senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese business and economics here at CSIS. His work covers a fantastically broad range of subjects, so it seems almost arbitrary that I've asked him to talk to me today about something like philanthropy rather than the trade war or all these other things that he works on. But until you learn that he was actually editor and a major contributor to a special China issue of Voluntas, which is the International Journal of Voluntary and Nonprofit Organizations, which is the official journal of the International Society for Third Sector Research, which you can download for free because it's an NGO and they better give it free. Anyway, Scott Kennedy, welcome at long last to Seneca. We have meant to have you on for the longest time.
Thanks so much, Kaiser. It's good to be with you.
So let's first talk about this volume that you edited for Voluntas, which, to judge from your contribution and from your nice summaries of the pieces in it, not all of which I have to confess I've actually managed to read, but I have to say it's a lot more interesting than I would have thought. I was kind of like prepared for total soporific powers. But anyway, you've actually been working, Scott, on philanthropy for quite some time now, when you were still a professor at Indiana, right?
Yes, that's quite correct. In 2012, we started this initiative on philanthropy. When I was still at IU, we did it together with the Center for Philanthropy at IU's Indianapolis campus. And they follow philanthropy throughout the world. And so we collaborated to look at China, which was just starting to build a philanthropic community, mm-hmm. Coming out of the 2008 Wenchuan earthquake, but starting to grow. And, you know, more and more people getting wealthy and wanting to help address a lot of the social needs that weren't being met by the state. And so we brought together a big group of experts from the United States and China, had a whole series of events, sent off folks to do research. Then they turned around and produced some fantastic papers, which we put together in this special issue that came out this summer.
That's great. Well, let's talk about what's in there. Let's start with some of the numbers and try to get a sense of how fast this whole third sector has grown by some of the different metrics that you shared in your research. Is there an easy way to say whether philanthropy in China has grown at a pace that's commensurate with the growth of wealth?
Yes, it has grown quickly, but it's still not where it could be. I think that's the best summary. In 2006, before the earthquake, total philanthropy in China was 1.6 billion U.S.
Wow, just 1.6 billion
yes,
U.S.
Yes, and to 2017, it reached $22 billion. So that's a huge increase in just over a decade. China now has 5,500 foundations, 3,700 of which are private, the rest sort of government connected. Mm-hmm. There's 800 plus thousand registered non-governmental organizations that help people. That's just registered, so probably people estimate about 1.5 million more unregistered NGOs. And China's wealthy, as you mentioned, there's more and more, not only millionaires, but billionaires are big donors. I think Jack Ma was the first to create a philanthropic trust, and several of his colleagues have followed after. It's a big number, but it's still not where it could be. It accounts for about 0.2% of Chinese GDP.
Relative to the U.S., which is what?
2% of GDP.
Wow.
So, I mean, China is a developing country in many ways at the per capita level, right? You go to Beijing and Shanghai, you don't feel like it's developing. But nevertheless, that means most of philanthropy in China is corporate, 65%. It's 35% individual. In the U.S., the numbers are flip-flopped.
Oh, wow.
And so China is growing quickly, but it has a long way to go before it is a philanthropic powerhouse.
So, Scott, a couple of numbers jumped out at me about the expansion of NGOs even during the last 5 years. I imagine that a lot of people would expect that the sheer number of nonprofits might have fallen off because of the NGO law, which we've talked about before on this show, and the tightening political climate more generally. So this doesn't exactly appear to be the case. So how have NGOs fared, in other words, under Xi Jinping? How has charity fared?
I guess one thing to say is that it's grown, but it's become more channeled into official organizations that the government is aware of and can monitor.
Yeah, makes sense.
So,
yeah.
So I think the reason why the official numbers have continued to grow is a lot of unregistered organizations ended up registering. It doesn't mean that the whole universe of organizations are a lot more. I also think just one important thing, just to get to something that you mentioned, charity. So philanthropy, part of philanthropy is charity. Philanthropy broadly is voluntary action for the public good. So that means not just helping people out in times of disaster or when they can't help themselves. It means support for the public good, whatever that means, where government or industry or others can't help. I think one of the interesting things that distinguishes China from elsewhere, we taught a class when I was at IU on philanthropy. And if you talk to Chinese about philanthropy and you talk to them about volunteerism and what they do, Americans think about volunteer activity as the fact that they did it willfully, whereas Chinese think about it as they didn't get paid.
I was volunteered.
And so you have lots of volunteer organizations in China, in schools and universities, which are not voluntary to participate in.
You mentioned right now that China is, in many ways, at least on a per capita basis, still a developing country. Where is China comparatively when you look at levels of philanthropic activity and compare them to other countries at similar levels of development, however you want to measure that?
I would say in absolute numbers, again, because China's got 1.4 billion people and a class of extremely wealthy people, absolute numbers, relatively large.
More interested in per capita, though.
In per capita, if you say China has around 9,000-10,000 per capita per year, it's pretty high.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of international indices that are used to measure philanthropy, not just donation, but volunteerism, income and other types of activities. And in one from 2015, China ranked 144th out of 145 countries.
Well, that is not a good showing for China, no. So there are all sorts of different objects of philanthropic activity, of giving, of volunteerism in China. You got rural education, well, education more generally. You got poverty alleviation, of course, different environmental causes, everything from, you know, wildlife protection, specific species of animals, to wetlands protection, cultural heritage preservation, the arts. Are there areas of philanthropic activity that have been particularly attractive for China's wealthy and for China's corporations?
Absolutely. By far, in a way, the number one place Chinese philanthropists are contributing is in education.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
And in I mean, everyone knows how important education is in China and how expensive it can be and how unevenly it is provided. And so you have a provision of all different types of programming and funds, particularly in rural China, for in villages, also in cities for unregistered population, folks that don't have residency permits, where you see philanthropy for them, new kinds of classes for all different kinds of training, from young, the very youngest, to the oldest who need job retraining.
Right.
It really is quite phenomenal. And it far outstrips any of the other places where there's philanthropy.
At a rough measure, what does it absorb?
Probably half of funding goes to education. And then, you know, I mean, disaster relief is when there's a big disaster, then all the money gets and effort gets channeled in those directions, which isn't surprising. The government knocks on folks' doors and taps them on shoulders, and there's a lot of effort to demonstrate that you're helping out. But far and away, the day-to-day number one driver of philanthropy is education, and then beyond that, healthcare is second.
Huh.
Arts and culture, and funny enough, I mean, even is environment is like fifth or sixth,
which is surprising, I think, to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, because I mean, we all know about air pollution. We know about China's water problems and soil, how much it contributes to climate change. And it gets funding, but it still doesn't come anywhere close to the amount of funding that goes into educational philanthropy.
Do you think that that's because of a crowding out effect, that so much giving is directed toward education? That
it could be. I mean, maybe we'll see those numbers rise. I think also some of the philanthropic activity, if it may possibly run into government opposition, local level, not just central, then people are maybe more careful. You can give to education till the cows come home and no one is going to be complaining about that. And it's, everyone understands the educational gap in China that needs to be met.
What about if you're giving to, say, the children of migrant workers, or programs designed to educate the children of migrant workers? I mean, when I was living in China, I felt like I was routinely reading about programs that were being shut down or defunded, or that was sort of an unsafe area of educational philanthropy.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see the numbers now. I just have the experience. I have a friend of mine who worked with a group to provide reading glasses for young kids in migrant schools.
Mm.
And one of the big obstacles to learning is the fact that it's difficult to read, especially if you can't see. And so they did that. Now, when you operate in those marginalized communities, you have to be very, very careful. So you have to develop good relations with the local authorities to do that. And it presents challenges. Also, to co-op farming, if you're going to potentially use land that someone may want for development, if you're using, especially like in the suburbs, then that can run into problems. So you can see all different kinds of potential challenges that will emerge in the course of this very entrepreneurial activity.
Which all ties into the main theme, I think, of the essay that you contributed to this volume. And it's really something that threads throughout the whole volume, which is, you know, this dual message of expectations and apprehension that I talked about, right? Obviously, the party state does not frown on philanthropic activity more generally. I mean, they want participation. They want a greater spirit of volunteerism, but not left to develop on its own without any party guidance, right? So what are they so worried about? I mean, maybe you can frame this issue for us, give us some examples of the Chinese state being threatened by or wary of philanthropic activity.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges. I mean, everybody knows that China's over the last 40 years grown faster, longer than ever before. China is now richer, stronger, safer, healthier than it's been in 200 years. But there's still gaps. There's lots of people that haven't won, that are losers in this competition. And the state can't cover everything. And the government knows that. The party knows that. And they have countenanced philanthropy as a way to help fill that gap, to help buttress the legitimacy of the state, to help to encourage Chinese citizens to help each other and address their basic needs. At the same time, they want to make sure that all of that activity buttresses the rule of the party and doesn't challenge it head on.
Right.
And this leadership, particularly under Xi Jinping, is more sensitive than ever, despite the fact, as I said, they're wealthier, safer than ever. But nevertheless, they want to make sure that there's no challenge to the authority. And so that's why they want everyone to register, while they want to have them focus on priorities that the state legitimates, that they get approval, that they don't do things which they wouldn't like. So, for example, philanthropy can include a lot of different things, actually physically helping people. But in the United States and Europe, a huge part of philanthropy is just advocacy.
Right.
You know, so think of Greenpeace going out, putting up banners and getting people to pay attention to issues which they otherwise wouldn't pay attention to, and really trying to shape the agenda of governments around the world and of companies and others. In China, that is not encouraged. So, for example, in environment and climate change, you get NGOs that participate in these type of activities, but they're mostly about execution, implementation.
Right. It's to be like building an app to track supply chain greening or something like that.
Yeah, right? those kind of things which fill gaps, help address basic needs. But Chinese philanthropists on the whole are not reshaping the agenda of China. They are not engaging in outright social justice. And so that is a big question that many folks who look at China as philanthropic community and ask, are they buttressing a system which we think just needs a little bit more help to reform and fix the problems, or are they helping a system stay in place that is basically unfair?
Sometimes you do see activism, philanthropy, for example. You'll see gigantic subway ad campaigns around banning elephant ivory or rhinoceros horns or things like that, tigers. So big sort of high-profile, charismatic megafauna. Right?
Yes, sure. Well, certainly, China has signed on to all those relevant treaties, and the central government would like China to be a good actor. And so those type of campaigns actually just seem to be consistent with the broader official message. And so it's not so much that the state is suppressing philanthropy so much as trying to channel it into ways that are supportive of it.
Right. For example, let's look at poverty alleviation, which is a gigantic goal ahead of 2021. They want to absolutely eliminate rural poverty, right? I mean, that's the goal. If you were let's take an extreme example, a foreign funded NGO, and you wanted to participate in this, would your participation be welcome, or would it be suspect? Would they treat you like?
Absolutely would be supported. I'll just give you one example.
Okay.
So Walmart. So Walmart has helped create a research center in Shanghai that looks at nutrition. And then does research on it and then go and does research out in the field and shows that Walmart is committed to supporting a population that is well-fed, can do all the things that they need, and emphasizes this a great deal in their advocacy in China. There are other companies that support fresh water, clean water, all different types of things. And so those are accepted for multinationals that are in China. Just about every single one of them has some type of philanthropic element to what they do.
Right.
It's part of showing that they're in China for the long haul, that they care about the country, not just making a buck.
Do you feel like it's moving away from just sort of greenwashing CSR and toward, you know, more genuine environmental or social commitments?
Certainly, I think Western companies are highly cognizant of how the philanthropy they engage in, whether it's external activities or corporate social responsibility programs, affect their bottom line, affect people's sense of trust of that organization.
Right.
And so they are quite strategic in what they do. On the other hand, I think there's some genuine altruism. I think if you went, you know, in talking to companies, executives, and your average folks that do this, they want to do well. They want to do good while doing well at the same time.
The double bottom line.
Right? Yes, that's right. We actually did a part of what we did, and we publish a little bit of the data in Voluntas, is to examine the motives that companies have in donating in China.
Yeah, I want to go into that study in a little bit, but a couple more issues I want to explore with you before we get to that. So a multinational company can come in, and the scope of its work is not going to be, you know, particularly challenged. We have a little more trouble when you have, say, a foreign-funded NGO that wants to do, say rights protection or that wants to do rule of law promotion, even things that seem like, at least on paper, they're in line with party goals. We're starting to wander into, you know, a little more difficult territory. Obviously, you know, if you want to go to the real extremes, if you start talking about things like Tibetan cultural preservation, we start, you know, encountering some real pushback from the state. It's tough, though. I mean, there are a lot of things that are in that gray area, though, in between these two extremes, right?
Yeah, I would call that gray area increasingly black, and there's
just off limits to foreign participation.
I think if you put a list of potential projects in front of your general counsel or folks back at HQ and gave them a sense of where China is politically, or you submitted it to the party committee of your company, for example, and you had help for minorities, if you had helping rights lawyers and those that don't have legal defense or in vulnerable situations, or massive public advocacy campaigns that could potentially embarrass authorities. Those are all kind of things that essentially be off limits. And so
gender issues, things like sexual harassment in the workplace, or
yeah, you'd have to find the most benign, vanilla way to introduce those topics. I mean, I think that's one of the signs of the new era under Xi Jinping, is that a lot of the gray has become black, and that the boundaries are less ambiguous than they were before. It used to be, if there wasn't a rule against it, you'd do it until someone told you not to.
Right.
I think now, if there's not a clear rule, you don't do it because you're worried that you could get squashed.
Right.
And so I think that's why, even though the numbers have risen in terms of overall philanthropy, I think the channeling of it means that there are still significant gaps in what philanthropy is trying to address. And it's getting the low-hanging fruit, the easy things, which are very important. I mean, helping reduce poverty and expand educational opportunity, helping those who can't afford healthcare receive basic support. Those are all really important. But there's other areas that are still out of bounds that aren't being addressed. Just one other thing that's really interesting is social entrepreneurship.
Mm.
And this has grown first in the US and Europe, but it's in China, where you create organizations which are supposed to create a profit, but also, as an inherent part of their business goals, serve the public good.
Microcredit lending.
Co-op farming.
Co-op farming, exactly.
A whole variety of things. And talking to the folks that do these things, they're actually extremely creative and smart. But they run into really difficult challenges in China in terms of the tax laws, in terms of local authorities, other stakeholders. Not necessarily because the center says you shouldn't do it, but they run into somebody with power someplace that gives them a hard time.
So yeah, we've talked quite a bit now about the political impediments to doing philanthropic work in China. What would you identify as some of the other ones? Are there, for example, cultural impediments? I mean, I don't know where you would put something like the fact that China is an extremely low trust environment, or just the sort of brutal ethos of "I'm going to screw you before you screw me." I would think that would affect attitudes toward it. And obviously, there is a lot of skepticism. You know, this 2016 charity law, It seems to have been, in part at least, a reaction to some of these abuses, perceived abuses at least. So maybe you could talk about some of what led to that.
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly there's low trust in China and concern about getting ahead. I tend to see these things less as millennial-long inherent traits placed in people's DNA from which they can't change. I really see the political social environment as changing these things, and the arrow is pointing in both ways. Just as an example, Chinese foundations have very low transparency. They have it's very hard to read their books. It's very hard to believe money, the numbers on them, just like Chinese companies, right? But one of the reasons for doing that is if you report everything that you do, you're potentially going to run into problems or have outsiders tell you what you should and shouldn't do. So they're very, you know, usually vague or inaccurate with what they report. And so in global standards, Chinese, the transparency of Chinese organizations are very low.
Right.
And so that's why when you survey Chinese and you say, who do you trust, who do you not trust, folks from Chinese NGOs tend to rate very low on the scale. So the charity law was meant to try and bring some of that into the light of day, to have some standards so that not only could government appropriately audit NGOs, but so that the public would trust them more. And so you've got to have a little bit more transparency and clarity and consistency for that. I think, it's been very difficult, for example, for Chinese NGOs and foundations to hire career staff. It's right. Not a career, philanthropic activities the way it is in the United States. Many foundations that are part of companies in China actually use their corporate executives to simultaneously staff the foundation. There's a conflict of interest waiting to happen.
Yeah.
It also means that these aren't people who really are experts in delivering philanthropy. It's actually not a simple task of just saying, let's all get together on one weekend and go off and help this group.
That's right.
It requires a great deal of planning.
And they're put in a bind by the fact that the 2016 charity law actually limits the amount of administrative expenditure, right? It caps it at
10%. Yes.
And so you're basically doomed never to have professionalism in a lot of these organizations.
Yeah. So this is the rule of unintended effects. They're worried that NGOs and foundations were absconding with donations. And probably some were.
And yeah, there's actually one high profile case involving a woman named Guo Meimei who apparently was, claiming some connection to the Chinese Red Cross and had conspicuously spent all this money on this and that and was boasting about it online and she got called out. But it seemed to really lower kind of trust in something as foundational as the Red Cross. Yeah,
I think that must have been 2011 or 12.
Yeah, that's about right.
And so and there were some philanthropic organizations that do research that also were connected to that case in ways that also reduce people's trust just in the whole field itself. But it is incredibly important. So I think those of us who want China to succeed and address its challenges want its philanthropic sector to be healthy, yet it contains some of the same pathologies of the society and system as a whole. And philanthropy and therefore philanthropy is never going to be where it needs to be until this sort of dual treatment of philanthropic actors changes, and you see a greater willingness to allow more variety and activities that aren't necessarily serving the state's needs of the moment.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about foreign NGOs and charitable giving into China. Actually, Mark Seidel wrote a piece on the NGO law, right, which we've talked about, again, like I said, on this program. First, what were the major takeaways from Seidel's piece?
I think basically what Mark wrote, he's a University of Wisconsin Law School, really one of the leading authorities on philanthropic law in Asia, not just in China,
right.
Is that there's a really good reason for China to come up not only with the charity law, but the foreign NGO law in 2016. They'd been operating on a string of temporary guidelines that overlapped, conflicted with each other, and you had a lot of regulation falling between the cracks. And so first of all, the need for regulation to address problems of governance and supervision and of service provision.
Right.
But secondly, I think as we've already said, some significant restrictions on what can and can't be done. And the transition from one era to the next era is going to be challenging for folks to come out the light of day, to register, to come into full compliance. It may end up being a healthier but smaller sector, or it may end up, if it's implemented in the wrong way, a sector which is smaller and also not helping folks the way they need to.
One thing that receives some attention in the U.S. and other international press is Chinese giving overseas. I've seen some examples of this, like after the Kathmandu earthquake, the Kathmandu Valley earthquake, there was, you know, the companies were kind of falling over one another to do things. So where is Chinese philanthropy going when it does go abroad?
So one of our contributors, Deng Guosheng, who's a professor at Tsinghua University, absolutely fantastic, grade A scholar and human being, wrote his article on Chinese philanthropy abroad.
Right.
And it's pretty impressive for a country, again, with as low per capita income as China, to be going abroad. Most of that work is in Africa.
Not surprisingly.
And following, again, not surprisingly, where most of Chinese investment in Africa is going. And so you'll see alongside infrastructure projects, mining, other projects, you'll see investment in hospitals, in education, other types of similar gifts. In addition, China has, I forget the name of this ship, but China has circling the world, a peace ship, which provides healthcare around the world. And they've provide service in over 100 plus countries.
Wow.
And so really, really quite impressive level of medical service. Chinese doctors and nurses, clinicians going around the world, treating people in very difficult circumstances all over the place. But nevertheless, again, it's a two-sided story. Yes, there's an amazing amount of growth, but it's still largely top-down. It's not just folks figuring out, hey, what's the need in one place or somewhere else, and going forth. They are clearing everything back home.
You talked earlier about a survey that you guys had commissioned about some interesting survey research that you had done. In 2014, you commissioned a survey of 700 companies, is that right?
Yes.
Looking at the reasons why they give. And it was really interesting to me, although not altogether surprising, that there's a pattern that emerges between the motivation, the reasons that they say they give, and actual philanthropic behavior. Can you talk about that and some of the other interesting correlations that survey surfaced?
Sure. When companies give, they couldn't be motivated by one of three general motivations. One is trying to do good, altruism. Another would be helping their business, helping its bottom line. And third would be politics, improving their relationship with the government or the party. And so this is something that occurs everywhere, as we mentioned before. And the question is, China similar or different from anywhere else? What motivates Chinese companies to give? And so you'd assume, given that it's China, that it's 100% politics. And, you know, we're doing a survey. So, you know, we've got one stranger asking another stranger about why their company is giving. We didn't do the survey. Horizon did it, and you know, we bought the data from them. But nevertheless, so but what we found in the survey is that, you know, companies generally say that they're giving for altruistic reasons. Yet they also say secondarily, that they're giving for political reasons, that they're trying to improve the relationship with the government, show that they're doing things that are consistent with government goals. It's interesting. Companies almost never say that they're doing this for business, for their bottom line. But it turns out that when you look at their actions, because the survey also asks how much did you donate, that companies are equally motivated by altruism and politics when you take into account what they actually do. And that makes Chinese companies relatively similar to companies in the rest of the world, except for state-owned enterprises. State-owned enterprises stand out as being almost entirely driven by political motives compared to their private and foreign brethren in China. And not only in terms of how much they give, but when they give. State-owned enterprises give primarily to address disasters, and that's when the state, again,
expects
everyone to come out. And so there's that huge difference between state-owned enterprises on the one hand and everybody else.
That's fascinating. Do you think that it's possible to draw some comparisons between philanthropy under different regime types? Do you think that we have enough data globally to look at it? I mean, you hint at that in your paper. I'm wondering how far you'd be willing to take that at this point, just based on what you know.
Sure. I mean, if you hold wealth constant, and of course you can't do that in real life, but generally you would expect, and I think the record shows, that in democracies where the state isn't trying to dominate and you have limited government with limited powers and limited abilities, philanthropy is larger. It's particularly large in the United States because of the tradition of philanthropy in the U.S. And I think it's interesting, you know, in China, you know, if you go back to the early 1990s, when just after Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour, that's when they were thinking, well, what does a modern society look like?
Right.
And so they came up with stock markets, bond markets, credit rating agencies. They came up with philanthropy. And you saw a burst of studies about all the different elements of the third sector and civil society. And, you know, despite the fact that we have very different traditions, political traditions, in many ways, China was trying to model its contemporary society's major components based on what it saw in the United States. Of course, when you do that, you get something quite different on the other side. but they weren't looking at sort of a European model, a German model for philanthropy. They're really looking at the U.S. And if you look at all the courses that are taught in China or the research centers in China that work on philanthropy, all of those folks went to major centers of philanthropic studies at Harvard, Stanford, the East-West Center in Hawaii, and elsewhere in the United States, and they brought back those ideas with them. And a lot of those ended up, you know, in the charity law.
Right. So there are obvious ways in which China could not possibly resemble the United States, and I don't know about the percentage of philanthropic activity in America that is from faith-based organizations, but that's one area where I imagine it's quite different from in China. Is, for example, the officially sanctioned Catholic Church in China a major philanthropic organization?
It engages in some degree of charity work, but it's not a big donor. Where you will see big donations is in temples.
Okay, yeah.
Right? And particularly along the southeastern coast of China, Fujian and Zhejiang, and you'll find lots of wealthy entrepreneurs who interact with temples, and they rebuild these temples. The temples engage in charity and other types of good works in their communities. That's quite significant, but you're not going to see so-called Western religions engaging in broad-based philanthropy on the scale that you'll see it in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So, Scott, if you were advising graduate students about fruitful and important areas of inquiry in this field of philanthropy, what are some of the topics you think you would steer them toward?
There are some issues simply about the evolution of philanthropy in China that we still need to understand. Social entrepreneurship, I mentioned already, these new types of ways of activism, of helping society, how well or poorly are they doing, how successful are they. Popular attitudes. We don't really know a heck of a lot about popular attitudes toward philanthropy and volunteerism and how it's changed over the last several years. But I think the biggest gaps we have, and where I think some of the most interesting work can be done, is in comparing trends in China to trends elsewhere to get at that question that you just asked about where does China fit in the world.
Yeah.
So taking certain types of organizations in China and comparing them with their cousins in India and Brazil and Russia and the United States, broad-based comparisons, or if you've got a lot of data just sitting around and you can crunch some numbers, I tend to feel more comfortable actually getting out in the field and going to several different places. And if you can isolate, you know, certain cities in China with certain cities in other places, you know, Hangzhou in China with Bangalore in India or something like that, then you can actually really focus in on the similarities and differences and try and hold a lot else constant. So really figuring out how China is similar or different. And then there are also some really interesting historical comparisons. So I think this is an area in which there's been so little. There's been a lot written that's descriptive, not a heck of a lot that's analytical, or and very little that's comparative.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. So Scott, in your day-to-day these days, you're not dealing a whole bunch with philanthropy now here at CSIS. Your day-to-day is involved very much in the trade war. Is there an overlap? I mean, are you seeing, for example, any impact of the trade war and the economic pressures that it's putting on China on philanthropic activity or on the ability, for example, of U.S.-based NGOs to direct or to coordinate charitable giving in China?
It's an unanswered question. That is great that you asked. My sense, anecdotally talking to companies, is that they are very careful about what they're doing in China across the board. And they are checking, rechecking absolutely everything that they do. And I think what the trade war has done is created a level of uncertainty about companies and their futures in China. And therefore, that has probably made them a little bit more hesitant about engaging in philanthropy because you may, on the one hand, trying to be proving your legitimacy and commitment to China on the one hand. On the other hand, there may be others outside China looking at that philanthropic work and thinking, oh, you're proving your commitment to China as it's currently ruled. Are you sure that that's what you want to send the world as your global message? So I think companies, you know, this is oftentimes their public relations offices or government affairs folks, that they must be conflicted. And so every element of U.S.-China relations is coming under scrutiny. Your business, people-to-people exchanges, education, legal exchanges, philanthropy must be feeling the same kind of squeeze.
Yeah. That's really unfortunate. Well, Scott Kennedy, thank you so much for taking the time. Let's move on now to the recommendations segment of our program. But first, I want to remind listeners that The Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with Cynica and with the other shows in the Cynica network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SupChina's daily newsletter. This thing is just chock full of great reads all about China, delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy, Lucas, Jiayun, that team does an amazing job. They just really work very hard to deliver great value for money. So sign up, spread the word, and show your support. Okay, on to recommendations. Scott, what do you have for us?
I want to recommend something for folks to watch, even though I have mixed feelings about it. And sorry to begin with that kind of advertisement. But there is there have been a slate of documentaries that have come out on China recently. I think most folks already have heard about American Factory.
Yeah, I've recommended it before.
Yes, yes. And so I want to recommend that people watch The China Hustle.
Mm.
Which is a documentary about short sellers and China. People probably maybe have heard of Muddy Waters.
Yeah, it's the most famous or infamous one.
That's
yeah.
right. And so there's two messages that come out of this documentary. One is Wall Street is crooked and pushing the stocks of Chinese companies on American investors who don't know any better and are taken to the cleaners. And the second and which is these folks step in and try and help them. The second message is that companies in China are all fraudulent, and China's in some ways a Potemkin village. I think the first message probably has more legs than the second, but I think both messages are going to resonate in this political era.
True or not.
Right. And so I'm encouraging people to watch it, because lots of folks are going to see it and ask questions about it. And you have one of the smartest audiences around that need to engage with everybody, not just in the China community. And so they need to understand, what is China like? And how do you separate the fraud from the reality, the truth from the fiction, the myth from the reality? Those are things that are really important. If you want to convey a complex, nuanced message about China, which is how I look at the country, then we have to educate ourselves and watch what everyone else is watching so that we can have that type of conversation, even those very difficult conversations.
Great. I haven't seen that yet, but boy, I have my opinions about Muddy Waters and the whole lot of those. I think they're right sometimes, often for the wrong reasons they're right.
Well, sure.
We'll talk about that another time.
Yeah. Well, I would agree that sometimes I would say what I take a lot of sympathy from them from the movie because they're definitely well-intentioned. Yes, they want folks to short sell and they'll make a bunch of money. But I think the original motive is they saw a bunch of stocks being pushed by small banks on Wall Street without anyone really knowing what was behind those companies.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, it's doing a public service. On the other hand, if you go too far and just simply make it a business strategy, then you're as bad as the folks that you're attacking in the first place. But as one person in the movie says, no one in that story are the good guys.
Right. I think they had a couple of early and important correct calls, and they did call a couple of just utterly fraudulent companies, Forest something, I can't remember what was the name of that.
Yeah.
And then after that, though, I feel like they had a hammer in their hand, and everything started looking very nail-like.
It did. Yeah. But I'm calling on your audience, who are really smart, to watch this with a sensitive eye and be ready to talk to folks who, in this era, where we challenge all sources of authority, to be ready to have that kind of conversation and see if they can say, you know what? Yes, there's lots of companies and organizations in China which don't do the right thing, but there's lots that actually are trying and developing that kind of mixed picture. And I think that's, if we're going to have an argument, a position in the United States and the West, which is we need to try to continue to engage China and not just simply decouple because it's too messy and complicated and dangerous, then we're going to have to school up on all the different arguments of folks who are simply universal critics, and then come up with a way to explain them that says conditional engagement is still better than the alternatives.
Yeah. So I want to recommend one essay in particular, but also really her whole body of work. The writer's name is Yangyang Cheng. She wrote recently on Sinophile a birthday letter to the People's Republic. The day that we're recording is the day before October 1st. It's September 30th today. So she wrote this quite moving, very heartfelt piece about her conflicted relationship with the country of her birth. She's a particle physicist, of all things, and a brilliant writer, really just quite good. In a very short time, she's made her voice a very important one, whether she's been writing on science, on politics, on the constant unresolvable tensions of just being a modern thinking Chinese person in the world, caught between the United States and China.
I think that's really important just to mention. You mentioned she's a particle physicist. Many folks who end up challenging the authority of governments started out as theoretical physicists.
Yes.
Andrei Sakharov.
Yeah, Fang
Liger. Yes, and others.
It's interesting. I guess they're steeped in quantum and the sort of unknowability of things or so.
Well, they're trying to explain things at their very smallest level or at the largest cosmological level. And usually you've got to come up with theories that explain that. And they usually run afoul of Marxist theories about how the world started.
She certainly is no Marxist, but I think she's a subtle thinker. I don't always agree with her, but most of the time she's very much on. And I highly recommend her. And fortunately, she's been writing a lot for Sup China. So you can find a lot of her writing on our website.
All right, I'm there.
All right, Scott. Hey, man, it was great to talk to you finally. Finally get you on the show. I mean, I can't believe all these years we've kept missing.
Well, I'm really glad that we finally did it, and hopefully it went well enough that you'll have me back again.
Oh, I absolutely will. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by Sup China and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn with editing help by Jason MacRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at @supchinanews, and make sure to check out our other podcasts. There's the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, which comes out every week, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, New Voices and Toffer Talk, the Middle Earth Podcast, which is all about the culture industry in China, and of course, our brand new family member, Strangers in China. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.